Susan belatedly realized that this wasn't Rhea, but the mistake really wasn't that odd. Aunt Cord wasn't as thin as Rhea, not yet, anyway, and more neatly dressed, except for her dirty gloves. Why her aunt was wearing gloves in the first place, Susan didn't know, let alone why they looked so smudged. But the mad look in her eyes was horribly similar.
"Good day to you, Miss Oh So Young and Pretty,"
Aunt Cord greeted her in a cracked, vivacious voice that made Susan's heart tremble. Aunt Cord curtsied, one-handed, holding the little box curled against her chest with the other.
"Where go ye on this fine autumn day? Where go ye so speedy? To no lover's arms, that seems sure, for one's dead and the other's ta'en."
Cordelia laughed again, thin lips drawing back from big white teeth, horse teeth almost. Her eyes glared in the sunlight.
"Her mind's broken," Susan thought. "Poor thing, poor old thing."
"Did thee put Dearborn up to it?"
Aunt Cord asked. She crept to Pylon's side and looked up at Susan with luminous, liquid eyes.
"Thee did, didn't thee? Aye. Perhaps thee even gave him the knife he used after running your lips o'er it for good luck. Ye're in it together, why not admit it? At least admit thee's laying with that boy, for I know it's true. I saw the way he looked at ye the day ye were sitting in the window, and the way ye looked back at him."
Susan said,
"If you'll have truth, I'll give it to ye. We're lovers, and we'll be man and wife ere year's end."
Cordelia raised one dirty glove to the blue sky and waved it as if saying hello to the gods. She screamed with mingled triumph and laughter as she waved.
"And to be wed, she thinks. Ooh, ye'd no doubt drink the blood of your victims on the marriage altar, too, would ye not? Oh, wicked! It makes me weep."
But instead of weeping, she laughed again, a howl of mirth into the blind blue face of the sky.
"We plan no murders," Susan said, drawing, if only in her own mind, a line of difference between the killings at Mayor's house and the trap they had hoped to spring on Farson's soldiers. "And he did no murders. No, this is the business of your friend Jonas, I wot. His plan, his filthy work."
Cordelia plunged her hand into the box she held, and Susan understood at once why the gloves she wore were dirty. She had been grubbing in the stove.
"I curse thee with the ashes,"
Cordelia cried, flinging a black and gritty cloud of them at Susan's leg and the hand which held Pylon's reins.
"I curse thee to darkness, both of thee. Be ye happy together, ye faithless, ye murderers, ye cousiners, ye liars, ye fornicators, ye lost and renounced."
With each cry, Cordelia Delgado threw another handful of ashes. And with each cry, Susan's mind grew clearer, colder. She held fast and allowed her aunt to pelt her. In fact, when Pylon, feeling the gritty rain against his side, attempted to pull away, Susan gigged him set. There were spectators now, avidly watching this old ritual of renunciation. Shimi was among them, eyes wide and mouth quivering, but Susan barely noticed. Her mind was her own again. She had an idea of what to do. And for that alone, she supposed she owed her aunt some sort of thanks.
"I forgive ye, aunt," she said.
The box of stove ashes, now almost empty, tumbled from Cordelia's hands as if Susan had slapped her.
"What?" she whispered. "What does thee say?"
"For what ye did to your brother and my father," Susan said. "For what ye were a part of."
She rubbed a hand on her leg and bent with the hand held out before her. Before her aunt could pull away, Susan had wiped ashes down one of her cheeks. The smudge stood out there like a wide, dark scar.
"But wear that all the same," she said. "Wash it off if you like, but I think you'll wear it in your heart yet a while."
She paused.
"I think you already do. Goodbye."
"Where does thee think thee's going?"
Aunt Cord was pawing at the soot mark on her face with one gloved hand, and when she lunged forward in an attempt to grasp Pylon's reins, she stumbled over the box and almost fell. It was Susan, still bent over to her aunt's side, who grasped her shoulder and held her up. Cordelia pulled back as if from the touch of an adder.
Not to him? You'll not go to him now, you mad goose.
Susan turned her horse away.
None of your business, Aunt. This is the end between us. But mark what I say, we'll be married by year's end. Our firstborn is already conceived.
Thee'll be married tomorrow night if thee goes nigh him, joined in smoke, wedded in fire, bedded in the ashes. Bedded in the ashes, do you hear me?
The madwoman advanced on her, railing. But Susan had no more time to listen. The day was fleeting. There would be time to do the things that needed doing, but only if she moved at speed.
Goodbye, she said again, and then galloped away.
Her aunt's last words followed her.
In the ashes, do you hear me?
3. On her way out of town along the great road, Susan saw riders coming toward her and got off the highway. This would not, she felt, be a good time to meet pilgrims. There was an old granary nearby. She rode Pylon behind it, stroked his neck, murmured for him to be quiet. It took the riders longer to reach her position than she would have expected, and when they finally got there, she saw why. Rhea was with them, sitting in a black cart covered with magical symbols. The witch had been scary when Susan had seen her on the night of the Kissing Moon, but still recognizably human. What the girl saw passing before her now, rocking from side to side in the black cart and clutching a bag in her lap, was an unsexed, sore-rattled creature that looked more like a troll than a human being. With her were the big coffin hunters.
"To seafront!" the thing in the cart screamed. "Hie you on, and at full speed. I'll sleep in Thorin's bed tonight or know the reason why. Sleep in it and piss in it if I take a notion. Hie you on, I say!"
De Pape, it was to his horse that the cart had been harnessed, turned around and looked at her with distaste and fear.
"Steal your mouth!"
Her answer was a fresh burst of laughter. She rocked from side to side, holding a bag on her lap with one hand and pointing at De Pape with the twisted, long-nailed index finger of the other. Looking at her made Susan feel weak with terror, and she felt the panic around her again, like some dark fluid that would happily drown her brain if given half a chance. She worked against the feeling as best she could, holding on to her mind, refusing to let it turn into what it had been before and would be again if she let it, a brainless bird trapped in a barn, bashing into the walls and ignoring the open window through which it had entered. Even when the cart was gone below the next hill and there was nothing left of them but dust hanging in the air, she could hear Rhea's wild cackling. 4. She reached the hut in the bad grass at 1 o'clock. For a moment she just sat astride Pylon, looking at it. Had she and Roland been here hardly 24 hours ago, making love and making plans? It was hard to believe. But when she dismounted and went in, the wicker basket in which she had brought them a cold meal confirmed it. It still sat upon the rickety table. Looking at the hamper, she realized she hadn't eaten since the previous evening, a miserable supper with Hart Thorin that she'd only picked at, too aware of his eyes on her body. Well, they'd done their last crawl, hadn't they? And she'd never have to walk down another seafront hallway wondering what door he was going to come bursting out of like Jack out of his box, all grabbing hands and stiff randy prick.
Ashes. She thought, ashes and ashes. But not us, Roland. I swear, my darling, not us.
She was frightened and tense, trying to put everything she now must do in order, a process to be followed, just as there was a process to be followed when saddling a horse. But she was also 16 and healthy. One look at the hamper and she was ravenous. She opened it, saw there were ants on the 2 remaining cold beef sandwiches, brushed them off and gobbled the sandwiches down. The bread had gotten rather stiff, but she hardly noticed. There was a half jar of sweet cider and part of a cake as well.
When she had finished everything, she went to the north corner of the hut and moved the hide someone had begun to cure and then lost interest in. There was a hollow beneath. Within it, wrapped in soft leather, were Roland's guns.
If things go badly, thee must come here and take them west to Gilead. Find my father.
With faint but genuine curiosity, Susan wondered if Roland had really expected she would ride blithely off to Gilead with his unborn child in her belly while he and his friends were roasted, screaming, and red-handed on the Reap Night bonfire.
She pulled one of the guns out of its holster. It took her a moment or two to see how to get the revolver open, but then the cylinder rolled out and she saw that each chamber was loaded. She snapped it back into place and checked the other one. She concealed them in the blanket roll behind her saddle, just as Roland had, then mounted up and headed east again. But not toward town. Not yet. She had one more stop to make first.
5. At around 2 o'clock, word that Fran Lengel would be speaking at the town gathering hall began to sweep through the town of Magus. No one could have said where this news, it was too firm and specific to be a rumor, began, and no one much cared. They simply passed it on. By 3 o'clock, the gathering hall was full, and 200 or more stood outside, listening as Lengel's brief address was relayed back to them in whispers. Carl Thorin, who had begun passing the news of Lengel's impending appearance at the Traveler's Rest, was not there. She knew what Lengel was going to say, had in fact supported Jonas's argument that it should be as simple and direct as possible. There was no need for rabble-rousing. The townsfolk would be a mob by sundown of Reaping Day. A mob always picked its own leaders, and it always picked the right ones. Lengel spoke with his hat held in one hand and a silver reap charm hanging from the front of his vest. He was brief, he was rough, and he was convincing. Most folks in the crowd had known him all their lives and didn't doubt a word he said. Hart Thorin and Kimba Reimer had been murdered by Dearborn, Heath, and Stockworth, Lengel told the crowd of men in denim and women in faded gingham. The crime had come home to them because of a certain item, a bird's skull, left in Mayor Thorin's lap. Murmurs greeted this. Many of Lengel's listeners had seen the skull, either mounted on the horn of Cuthbert's saddle or worn jauntily around his neck. They had laughed at his prankishness. Now they thought of how he had laughed back at them, and realized he must have been laughing at a different joke all along. Their faces darkened. The weapon used to slit the Chancellor's throat, Lengel continued, had belonged to Dearborn. The three young men had been taken that morning as they prepared to flee Magus. Their motivations were not entirely clear, but they were likely after horses. If so, they would be for John Farson, who was known to pay well for good nags and in cash. They were, in other words, traitors to their own lands and to the cause of the affiliation. Lengel had planted Brian Hookey's son, Rufus, 3 rows back. Now, exactly on time, Rufus Hookey shouted out, "Has they confessed?" "Aye," Lengel said, "confessed both murders and spoke it most proud, so they did." A louder murmur at this, almost a rumble. It ran backward like a wave to the outside, where it went from mouth to mouth. "Most proud, most proud. They had murdered in the dark of night and spoke it most proud." Mouths were tucked down, fists clenched. "Dearborn said that Jonas and his friends had caught on to what they were doing and took the word to Reimer. They killed Chancellor Reimer to shut him up while they finished their chores, and Thorin in case Reimer had passed word on." This made little sense, Letigo had argued. Jonas had smiled and nodded. "No," he had said, "not a mite of sense, but it doesn't matter." Lengel was prepared to answer questions, but none were asked. There was only the murmur, the dark looks, the muted click and clink of reap charms as people shifted on their feet. The boys were in jail. Lengel made no statement concerning what would happen to them next, and once again he was not asked. He said that some of the activities scheduled for the next day, the games, the rides, the turkey run, the pumpkin carving contest, the pig scramble, the riding competition, and the dance, had been cancelled out of respect for the tragedy.
The things that really mattered would go on, of course, as they always had and must. The cattle and livestock judging, the horse pull, the sheep shearing, the stock line meetings and the auctions. Horse, pig, cow, sheep. And the bonfire at moonrise. The bonfire and the burning of the guys. Charyu tree was the end of reaping fair day, and had been since time out of mind. Nothing would stop it save the end of the world.
"The bonfire will burn, and the stuffy guys will burn on it," Eldred Jonas had told Lengil. "That's all you're to say. It's all you need to say."
And he'd been right, Lengil saw. It was on every face. Not just the determination to do right, but a kind of dirty eagerness. There were old ways, old rites of which the red-handed stuffy guys were one surviving remnant. There were los ceremoniosos, charyu tree. It had been generations since they had been practiced, except every once and again in secret places out in the hills. But sometimes when the world moved on, it came back to where it had been.
"Keep it brief," Jonas had said, and it had been fine advice indeed.
He wasn't a man Lengil would have wanted around in more peaceful times, but a useful one in times such as these.
"Gods give you peace," he said now, stepping back and folding his arms with his hands on his shoulders to show he had finished. "Gods give us all peace."
"Long days and peaceful nights," they returned in a low automatic chorus. And then they simply turned and left, to go wherever folks went on the afternoon before reaping. For a good many of them, Lengil knew it would be the Traveler's Rest or the Bayview Hotel. He raised a hand and mopped his brow. He hated to be out in front of people, and never so much as today. But he thought it had gone well. Very well indeed.
6. The crowd streamed away without speaking. Most, as Lengil had foreseen, headed for the saloons. Their way took them past the jail, but few looked at it, and those few who did so in tiny, furtive glances. The porch was empty, save for a plump, red-handed stuffy sprawled in Sheriff Avery's rocker, and the door stood ajar, as it usually did on warm and sunny afternoons. The boys were inside, no doubt about that, but there was no sign that they were being guarded with any particular zeal. If the men passing on their way downhill to the Rest and the Bayview had banded together into one group, they could have taken Roland and his friends with no trouble whatsoever. Instead, they went by with their heads down, walking stolidly and with no conversation, to where the drinks were waiting. Today was not the day, nor tonight. Tomorrow, however...
7. Not too far from the barquet, Susan saw something on the barony's long slope of grazing land that made her rein up and simply sit in the saddle with her mouth open. Below her, and much farther east of her position, at least 3 miles away, a band of a dozen cowboys had rounded up the biggest herd of drop runners she had ever seen, perhaps 400 head in all. They ran lazily, going where the vax pointed them with no trouble.
"Probably think they're going in for the winter," Susan thought.
But they weren't headed in toward the ranches running along the crest of the drop. The herd, so large it flowed on the grass like a cloud shadow, was headed west toward Hanging Rock. Susan had believed everything Roland said, but this made it true in a personal way, one she could relate directly to her dead father.
"Horses, of courses."
"You bastards," she murmured. "You horse-thieving bastards!" She turned pylon and rode for the burned-out ranch. To her right, her shadow was growing long. Overhead, the demon moon glimmered ghostly in the daylight sky.
8. She had worried that Jonas might have left men at the barquet, although why he would have, she didn't really know, and the fear turned out to be groundless in any case. The ranch was as empty as it had been for the 5 or 6 years between the fire that had put paid to it and the arrival of the boys from Inworld.
She could see signs of that morning's confrontation, however, and when she went into the bunkhouse where the three of them had slept, she at once saw the gaping hole in the floorboards. Jonas had neglected to close it up again after taking a lens and Cuthbert's guns. She went down the aisle between the bunks, dropped to one knee, and looked into the hole. Nothing. Yet she doubted if what she had come for had been there in the first place. The hole wasn't big enough. She paused, looking at the three cots. Which was Roland's? She supposed she could find out. Her nose would tell her. She knew the smell of his hair and skin very well. But she thought she would do better to put such soft impulses behind her. What she needed now was to be hard and quick, to move without pausing or looking back. "Ashes," Aunt Cord whispered in her head, almost too faintly to hear. Susan shook her head impatiently as if to clear that voice away and walked out back. There was nothing behind the bunkhouse, nothing behind the privy or to either side of it. She went around to the back of the old cook shack next, and there she found what she'd come looking for, placed casually and with no attempt at concealment. The two small barrels she had last seen slung over Capricoso's back. The thought of the mule summoned the thought of Sheeny looking down at her from his man's height and with his hopeful boy's face.
"I'd like to take a finda año kiss from you, so I would."
Sheeny, whose life had been saved by Mr. Arthur Heath. Sheeny, who had risked the wrath of the witch by giving Cuthbert the note meant for her aunt. Sheeny, who had brought these barrels up here. They had been smeared with soot to partially camouflage them, and Susan got some on her hands and the sleeves of her shirt as she took off the tops. More ashes. But the firecrackers were still inside, the round, fist-sized big bangers and the smaller ladyfingers. She took plenty of both, stuffing her pockets until they bulged and carrying more in her arms. She stowed them in her saddlebags, then looked up at the sky. 3:30. She wanted to get back to Hambry no earlier than twilight, and that meant at least an hour to wait. There was a little time to be soft after all. Susan went back into the bunkhouse and found the bed which had been Roland's easily enough. She knelt beside it like a child saying bedtime prayers, put her face against his pillow, and inhaled deeply. "Roland," she said, her voice muffled, "how I love thee! How I love thee, dear!" She lay on his bed and looked toward the window, watching the light drain away. Once she raised her hands in front of her eyes, examining the barrel soot on her fingers. She thought of going to the pump in front of the cookhouse and washing, but decided not to. Let it stay. They were quartet, one from many, strong in purpose and strong in love. Let the ashes stay and do their worst. 9. "My Susie has her faults, but she's always on time," Pat Delgado used to say. "Fearful punctual, that girl." It was true on the night before Reap. She skirted her own house and rode up to the Traveler's Rest not 10 minutes after the sun had finally gone behind the hills, filling the high street with thick mauve shadows. The street was eerily deserted, considering it was the night before Reap. The band which had played in Greenheart every night for the last week was silent. There were periodic rattles of firecrackers, but no yelling, laughing children. Only a few of the many colored lamps had been lit. Stuffy guys seemed to peer from every shadow-thickened porch. Susan shivered at the sight of their blank, white cross eyes. Doings at the rest were similarly odd. The hitching rails were crowded, even more horses had been tied at the rails of the mercantile across the street, and light shone from every window. So many windows and so many lights that the inn looked like a vast ship on a darkened sea. But there was none of the usual riot and jubilation, all set to the jagtime tunes pouring out of Sheb's piano. She found she could imagine the customers inside all too well. 100 men, maybe more, simply standing around and drinking. Not talking, not laughing, not chucking the dice down Satan's alley and cheering or groaning at the result. No bottoms stroked or pinched, no reap kisses stolen, no arguments started out of loose mouths and finished with hard fists.
Just men drinking, not 300 yards from where her love and his friends were locked up. The men who were here wouldn't do anything tonight but drink, though. And if she was lucky, brave and lucky... As she drew Pylon up in front of the saloon with a murmured word, a shape rose out of the shadows. She tensed, and then the first orangey light of the rising moon caught Sheenie's face. She relaxed again, even laughed a little, mostly at herself. He was a part of their quartet. She knew he was. Was it surprising that he should know as well?
"Susan," he murmured, taking off his sombrero and holding it against his chest. "I've been waiting for ye."
"Why?" she asked.
"'Cause I knew ye'd come."
He looked back over his shoulder at the rest, a black bulk spraying crazy light toward every point of the compass.
"We're going to let Arthur and them free, ain't we?"
"I hope so," she said.
"We have to. The folks in there, they don't talk, but they don't have to talk. I knows, Susan, daughter of Pat, I knows."
She supposed he did.
"Is Carl inside?"
Sheenie shook his head.
"Gone up to Mayor's house. She told Stanley she was going to help lay out the bodies for the funeral day after tomorrow, but I don't think she'll be here for the funeral. I think the big coffin hunters is going, and she'll go with him."
He raised a hand and swiped at his leaking eyes.
"Your mule, Sheenie, all saddled, and I got the long halter."
She looked at him, open-mouthed.
"How did you know? Same way I knew ye'd be coming, Susan Sy. I just knew."
He shrugged, then pointed vaguely.
"Cappy's around the back. I tied him to the cook's pump."
"That's good." She fumbled in the saddlebag where she had put the smaller firecrackers.
"Here, take some of these. Do we have a sulfur or two?"
"Aye."
He asked no questions, simply stuffed the firecrackers into his front pocket. She, however, who had never been through the batwing doors of the Traveler's Rest in her whole life, had another question for him.
"What do they do with their coats and hats and serapes when they come in, Sheenie? They must take 'em off. Drinking's warm work." "Oh, aye. They puts 'em on a long table just inside the door. Some fights about whose is whose when they're ready to go home."
She nodded, thinking hard and fast. He stood before her, still holding a sombrero against his chest, letting her do what he could not, at least not in the conventionally understood way. At last she raised her head again.
"Sheenie, if you help me, you're done in Hambry, done in Mages, done in the Outer Ark. You go with us if we get away. You have to understand that, do you?"
She saw he did. His face fairly shone with the idea.
"Aye, Susan, go with you and Will Dearborn and Richard Stockworth and my best friend, Mr. Arthur Heath. Go to Inworld. We'll see buildings and statues and women in gowns like fairy princesses, and if we're caught, we'll be killed."
He stopped smiling, but his eyes didn't waver.
"Aye, killed we'll be if tain, most like."
"Will you still help me?"
"Cappy's all saddled,"
he repeated. Susan reckoned that was answer enough. She took hold of the hand, pressing the sombrero to Sheenie's chest. The hat's crown was pretty well crushed, and not for the first time. She bent, holding Sheenie's fingers with one hand and the horn of her saddle with the other, and kissed his cheek. He smiled up at her.
"We'll do our best, won't we?"
she asked him.
"Aye, Susan, daughter of Pat, we'll do our best for our friends, our very best."
"Yes.
Now listen, Sheenie, very carefully."
She began to talk, and Sheenie listened. 10. 20 minutes later, as the bloated orange moon struggled above the buildings of the town like a pregnant woman climbing a steep hill, a lone vaquero led a mule along Hill Street in the direction of the sheriff's office. This end of Hill Street was a pit of shadows. There was a little light around Greenheart, but even the park, which would have been thronged, noisy, and brilliantly lit in any other year, was mostly empty. Nearly all the booths were closed, and of those few that remained open, only the fortune-teller was doing any business. Tonight all fortunes were bad, but still they came, don't they always? The vaquero was wearing a heavy serape. If this particular cowboy had the breasts of a woman, they were concealed. The vac wore a large, sweat-stained sombrero. If this cowboy had the face of a woman, it was likewise concealed. Low, from beneath that hat's broad brim, came a voice singing Careless Love. The mule's small saddle was buried under the large bundle which had been roped to it. Cloth or clothes of some kind it might have been, although the deepening shadows made it impossible to say for sure. Most amusing of all was what hung around the mule's neck, like some peculiar reap charm, two sombreros and a drover's hat, strung on a length of rope. As the vac neared the sheriff's office, the singing ceased. The place might have been deserted if not for the single dim light shining through one window. In the porch rocker was a comical, stuffy guy wearing one of Herc Avery's embroidered vests and a tin star. There were no guards, absolutely no sign that the three most hated men in Magus were sequestered within. And now, very faintly, the vaquero could hear the strum of a guitar. It was blotted out by a thin rattle of firecrackers. The vac looked over one shoulder and saw a dim figure. It waved. The vaquero nodded, waved back, then tied the mule to the hitching post, the same one where Roland and his friends had tied their horses when they had come to introduce themselves to the sheriff on a summer day so long ago. The door opened, no one had bothered to lock it, while Dave Hollis was trying for about the 200th time to play the bridge of Captain Mills, You Bastard. Across from him, Sheriff Avery sat, rocked back in his desk chair, with his hands laced together on his paunch. The room flickered with mild orange lamplight.
"You keep it up, Deputy Dave, and there won't have to be any execution," Cuthbert Allgood said. He was standing at the door of one of the cells, with his hands wrapped around the bars. "We'll kill ourselves, in self-defense."
"Shut up, maggot," Sheriff Avery said.
He was half-dozing in the wake of a four-chopped dinner, thinking of how he would tell his brother and his brother's wife, who was killing pretty in the next barony, about this heroic day. He would be modest, but he would still get it across to them that he'd played a central role, that if not for him, these three young ladrones might have... "Just don't sing," Cuthbert said to Dave.
"I'll confess to the murder of Arthur Eld himself if you just don't sing."
To Bert's left, Alain was sitting cross-legged on his bunk. Roland was lying on his, with his hands behind his head, looking up at the ceiling. But at the moment the door's latch clicked, he swung to a sitting position, as if he'd only been waiting.
"That'll be Bridger,"
Deputy Dave said, gladly putting his guitar aside. He hated this duty and couldn't wait to be relieved. Heath's jokes were the worst, that he could continue to joke in the face of what was going to happen to them tomorrow.
"I think it's likely one of them," Sheriff Avery said, meaning the big coffin hunters.
In fact, it was neither. It was a cowboy all but buried in a serape that looked much too big for him, the ends actually dragged on the boards as he clumped in and shut the door behind him, and wearing a hat that came way down over his eyes. To Herc Avery, the fellow looked like somebody's idea of a cowboy stuffy.
"Say, stranger," he said, beginning to smile, for this was surely someone's joke, and Herc Avery could take a joke as well as any man, especially after four chops and a mountain of mashed. "Howdy, what business do you—"
The hand which hadn't closed the door had been under the serape. When it came out, it was clumsily holding a gun all three of the prisoners recognized at once. Avery stared at it, his smile slowly fading. His hands unlaced themselves. His feet, which had been propped up on his desk, came down to the floor.
"Whoa, partner," he said slowly. "Let's talk about it." "Get the keys off the wall and unlock the cells,"
the vac said in a hoarse, artificially deep voice. Outside, unnoticed by all save Roland, more firecrackers rattled in a dry, popping string.
"I can't hardly do that," Avery said, easing open the bottom drawer of his desk with his foot.
There were several guns left over from that morning inside.
Now, I don't know if that thing's loaded, but I don't hardly think a trail dog like you...
The newcomer pointed the gun at the desk and pulled the trigger. The report was deafening in the little room, but Roland thought, hoped, that with the door shut, it would sound like just another firecracker, bigger than some, smaller than others. Good girl, he thought. Oh, good girl. But be careful. For God's sake, Sue, be careful. All three of them standing in a line at the cell doors now, eyes wide and mouths tight. The bullet struck the corner of the sheriff's roll top and tore off a huge splinter. Avery screamed, tilted back in his chair again, and went sprawling. His foot remained hooked under the drawer pole. The drawer shot out and overturned, spilling three ancient firearms across the board floor.
"Susan, look out!" Cuthbert shouted, and then, "No, Dave!"
At the end of his life, it was duty, and not fear of the big coffin hunters, which propelled Dave Hollis, who had hoped to be sheriff of Magus himself when Avery retired, and, he sometimes told his wife Judy, a better one than Fratso had ever dreamed of being. He forgot that he had serious questions about the way the boys had been taken, as well as about what they might or might not have done. All he thought of then was that they were prisoners of the barony, and such would not be taken if he could help it. He lunged for the cowboy in the two big clothes, meaning to tear the gun out of his hands, and shoot him with it if necessary. 12. Susan was staring at the yellow blaze of fresh wood on the corner of the sheriff's desk, forgetting everything in her amazement, so much damage inflicted by the single twitch of a finger, when Cuthbert's desperate shout awakened her to her position. She shrank back against the wall, avoiding Dave's first swipe at the oversized serape, and without thinking pulled the trigger again. There was another loud explosion, and Dave Hollis, a young man only 2 years older than she herself, was flung backward with a smoking hole in his shirt between two points of the star he wore. His eyes were wide and unbelieving. His monocle lay by one outstretched hand on its length of black silk ribbon. One of his feet struck his guitar and knocked it to the floor with a thrum nearly as musical as the chords he had been trying to make.
"Dave," she whispered. "Oh, Dave, I'm sorry. What did I do?"
Dave tried once to get up, then collapsed forward on his face. The hole going into the front of him was small, but the one she was looking at now, the one coming out the back, was huge and hideous, all black and red and charred edges of cloth, as if she had run him through with a blazing hot poker instead of shooting him with a gun, which was supposed to be merciful and civilized, and was clearly neither one.
"Dave," she whispered. "Dave, I...
Susan, look out!" Roland shouted. It was Avery. He scuttled forward on his hands and knees, seized her around the calves, and yanked her feet out from under her. She came down on her bottom with a tooth-rattling crash and was face to face with him, his frog-eyed, large-pored face, his garlic-smelling hole of a mouth.
"God, you're a girl,"
he whispered and reached for her. She pulled the trigger of Roland's gun again, setting the front of her serape on fire and blowing a hole in the ceiling. Plaster dust drifted down. Avery's ham-sized hands settled around her throat, cutting off her wind. Somewhere far away, Roland shrieked her name. She had one more chance. Maybe.
"One's enough, Sue," her father spoke inside of her head. "One's all you need, my dear."
She cocked Roland's pistol with the side of her thumb, socked the muzzle deep into the flab hanging from the underside of Sheriff Herc Avery's head, and pulled the trigger. The mess was considerable. 13. Avery's head dropped into her lap, as heavy and wet as a raw roast. Above it she could feel growing heat. At the bottom edge of her vision was the yellow flicker of fire.
"On the desk!"
Roland shouted, yanking the door of his cell so hard it rattled in its frame.
"Susan, the water pitcher, for your father's sake!"
She rolled Avery's head out of her lap, got to her feet, and staggered to the desk with the front of the serape burning. She could smell its charred stench, and was grateful in some far corner of her mind that she'd had time, while waiting for dusk, to tie her hair behind her. The pitcher was almost full, but not with water. She could smell the sweet, sour tang of graff. She doused herself with it, and there was a brisk hissing as the liquid hit the flames. She stripped the serape off, the oversized sombrero came with it, and threw it on the floor. She looked at Dave again, a boy she had grown up with, one she might even have kissed behind the door of Hookie's once upon an antique time.
"Susan!"
It was Roland's voice, harsh and urgent.
"The keys, hurry!"
Susan grabbed the key ring from the nail on the wall. She went to Roland's cell first and thrust the ring blindly through the bars. The air was thick with smells of gun smoke, burned wool, blood. Her stomach clenched helplessly at every breath. Roland picked the right key, reached back through the bars with it, and plunged it into the lockbox. A moment later he was out and hugging her roughly as her tears broke. A moment after that, Cuthbert and Alain were out as well.
"You're an angel," Alain said, hugging her himself.
"Not I," she said, and began to cry harder.
She thrust the gun at Roland. It felt filthy in her hand. She never wanted to touch one again.
"Him and me played together when we were berries. He was one of the good ones, never a braid-puller or a bully, and he grew up a good one. Now I've ended him, and who'll tell his wife?"
Roland took her back into his arms and held her there for a moment. "You did what you had to. If not him, then us. Does he not know it?" She nodded against his chest.
"Avery, him I don't mind so much, but Dave—"
"Come on," Roland said. Someone might recognize the gunshots for what they were. Was it Sheamy throwing firecrackers? She nodded.
"I've got clothes for you, hats and serapes."
Susan hurried back to the door, opened it, peeked out in either direction, then slipped into the growing dark. Cuthbert took the charred serape and put it over Deputy Dave's face.
"Tough luck, partner," he said. "You got caught in between, didn't you? I reckon you wasn't so bad."
Susan came back in, burdened with the stolen gear which had been tied to Cappy's saddle. Sheamy was already off on his next errand without having to be told. If the inn-boy was a half-wit, she'd known a lot of folks in her time who were running on quarters and eighths.
"Where'd you get this stuff?" Alain asked.
"The Traveler's Rest, and I didn't. Sheamy did."
She held the hats out.
"Come on, hurry."
Cuthbert took the headgear and passed it out. Roland and Alain had already slipped into the serapes. With the hats added and pulled well down over their faces, they could have been any drop vax in barony.
"Where are we going?"
Alain asked as they stepped out onto the porch. The street was still dark and deserted at this end. The gunshots had attracted no attention.
"Hookies to start with," Susan said. "That's where your horses are."
They went down the street together in a little group of four. Cappy was gone. Sheamy had taken the mule along. Susan's heart was thudding rapidly, and she could feel sweat standing out on her brow, but she still felt cold. Whether or no what she had done was murder, she had ended two lives this evening, and crossed a line that could never be recrossed in the other direction. She had done it for Roland, for her love, and simply knowing she could have done no different now offered some consolation.
"Be happy together, ye faithless, ye cousiners, ye murderers! I curse thee with the ashes!"
Susan seized Roland's hand, and when he squeezed, she squeezed back. And as she looked up at Demon Moon, its wicked face now draining from choleric red-orange to silver, she thought that when she had pulled the trigger on poor earnest Dave Hollis, she had paid for her love with the dearest currency of all. Had paid with her soul. If he left her now, her aunt's curse would be fulfilled, for only ashes would remain. Chapter 9. Reaping. 1. As they stepped into the stable, which was lit by one dim gas lamp, a shadow moved out of one of the stalls. Roland, who had belted on both guns, now drew them. Sheamy looked at him with an uncertain smile, holding a stirrup in one hand. Then the smile broadened, his eyes flashed with happiness, and he ran toward them. Roland holstered his guns and made ready to embrace the boy, but Sheamy ran past him and threw himself into Cuthbert's arms.
"Whoa, whoa," Cuthbert said, first staggering back comically and then lifting Shimi off his feet. "You like to knock me over, boy."
"She got you out," Shimi cried. "Knew she would, so I did. Good old Susan."
Shimi looked around at Susan, who stood beside Roland. She was still pale, but now seemed composed. Shimi turned back to Cuthbert and planted a kiss directly in the center of Bert's forehead.
"Whoa," Bert said again. "What's that for?"
"'Cause I love you, good old Arthur Heath. You saved my life."
"Well, maybe I did," Cuthbert said, laughing in an embarrassed way. His borrowed sombrero, too large to begin with, now sat comically askew on his head. "But if we don't get a move on, I won't have saved it for long."
"Horses are all saddled," Shimi said. "Susan told me to do it, and I did. I did it just right. I just have to put this stirrup on Mr. Richard Stockworth's horse, because the one on there's about worn through."
"That's a job for later," Alan said, taking the stirrup. He put it aside, then turned to Roland. "Where do we go?" Roland's first thought was that they should return to the Thorin mausoleum. Shimi reacted with instant horror.
"The boneyard? And with Demon Moon at the full?"
He shook his head so violently that his sombrero came off and his hair flew from side to side.
"They're dead in there," sighed Dearborn, "but if you tease them during the time of the demon, they's apt to get up and walk."
"It's no good anyway," Susan said. "The women of the town will be lining the way from seafront with flowers and filling the mausoleum, too. Olive will be in charge if she's able, but my aunt and Coral are apt to be in the company. Those aren't ladies we want to meet." "All right," Roland said. "Let's mount up and ride. Think about it, Susan. You too, Shimi. We want a place where we can hide up until dawn, at least. And it should be a place we can get to in less than an hour. Off the Great Road, and in any direction from Hambry but northwest." "Why not northwest?" Alan asked. "Because that's where we're going now. We've got a job to do, and we're going to let them know we're doing it. Eldred Jonas, most of all." He offered a thin blade of a smile. "I want him to know the game is over. No more castles. The real gunslingers are here. Let's see if he can deal with them." 2. An hour later, with the moon well above the trees, Roland's quartet arrived at the Sitgo oil patch. They rode out parallel to the Great Road, for safety's sake. But as it happened, the caution was wasted. They saw not one rider on the road going in either direction. "It's as if reaping's been cancelled this year," Susan thought. Then she thought of the red-handed stuffies and shivered. They would have painted Roland's hands red tomorrow night, and still would if they were caught. Not just him, either. All of us. Shimi, too. They left the horses, and Capricoso, who had trotted ill-temperedly but nimbly behind them on a tether tied to some long-dead pumping equipment in the southeastern corner of the patch, and then walked slowly toward the working derricks, which were clustered in the same area. They spoke in whispers when they spoke at all. Roland doubted if that was necessary, but whispers here seemed natural enough. To Roland, Sitgo was far spookier than the graveyard, and while he doubted that the dead in that latter place awoke, even when old Demon was full, there were some very unquiet corpses here, squalling zombies that stood rusty weird in the moonlight, with their pistons going up and down like marching feet. Roland led them into the active part of the patch nevertheless, past a sign which read, "How's your hard hat?" and another reading, "We produce oil, we refine safety." They stopped at the foot of a derrick, grinding so loudly that Roland had to shout in order to be heard. "Shimi, give me a couple of those big bangers." Shimi had taken a pocketful from Susan's saddlebag and now handed a pair of them over. Roland took Bert by the arm and pulled him forward. There was a square of rusty fencing around the derrick, and when the boys tried to climb it, the horizontals snapped like old bones. They looked at each other in the running shadows, combined of machinery and moonlight, nervous and amused. Susan twitched Roland's arm. "Be careful," she shouted, over the rhythmic wompa, wompa, wompa of the derrick machinery. She didn't look frightened, he saw, only excited and alert.
He grinned, pulled her forward, and kissed the lobe of her ear. "Be ready to run," he whispered. "If we do this right, there's going to be a new candle here at Sitco, a hellacious big one." He and Cuthbert ducked under the lowest strut of the rusty derrick tower and stood next to the equipment, wincing at the cacophony. Roland wondered that it hadn't torn itself apart years ago. Most of the works were housed in rusty metal blocks, but he could see a gigantic turning shaft of some kind, gleaming with oil that must be supplied by automated jets. Up this close, there was a gassy smell that reminded him of the jet that flared rhythmically on the other side of the oil patch. "Giant farts!" Cuthbert shouted.
"What? I said it smells like... Ah, never mind. Let's do it if we can. Can we?"
Roland didn't know. He walked toward the machinery, crying out beneath metal cowls which were painted a faded, rusting green. Bert followed with some reluctance. The two of them slid into a short aisle, smelly and baking hot, that took them almost directly beneath the derrick. Ahead of them, the shaft at the end of the piston turned steadily, shedding oily teardrops down its smooth sides. Beside it was a curved pipe, almost surely an overflow pipe, Roland thought. An occasional drop of crude oil fell from its lip, and there was a black puddle on the ground beneath. He pointed at it, and Cuthbert nodded. Shouting would do no good in here. The world was a roaring, squealing din. Roland curled one hand around his friend's neck and pulled Cuthbert's ear to his lips. He held a big bang up in front of Bert's eyes with the other.
"Light it and run," he said. "I'll hold it, give you as much time as I can. That's for my benefit as much as for yours. I want a clear path back through that machinery. Do you understand?"
Cuthbert nodded against Roland's lips, then turned the gunslinger's head so he could speak in the same fashion.
"What if there's enough gas here to burn the air when I make a spark?"
Roland stepped back, raised his palms in a how-do-I-know gesture. Cuthbert laughed and drew out a box of sulfur matches which he had scooped off Avery's desk before leaving. He asked with his eyebrows if Roland was ready. Roland nodded. The wind was blowing hard, but under the derrick the surrounding machinery cut it off, and the flame from the sulfur rose straight. Roland held out the big banger and had a momentary painful memory of his mother, how she had hated these things, how she had always been sure that he would lose an eye or a finger to one. Cuthbert tapped his chest above his heart and kissed his palm in the universal gesture of good luck. Then he touched the flame to the fuse. It began to sputter. Bert turned, pretended to bang off a covered block of machinery. That was Bert, Roland thought. He would joke on the gallows. And then dashed back down the short corridor they'd used to get here. Roland held the round firework as long as he dared, then lobbed it into the overflow pipe. He winced as he turned away, half expecting what Bert was afraid of, that the very air would explode. It didn't. He ran down the short aisle, came into the clear, and saw Cuthbert standing just outside the broken bit of fencing. Roland flapped both hands at him. "Go, you idiot, go!" And then the world blew up behind him. The sound was a deep, belching thud that seemed to shove his eardrums inward and suck the breath out of his throat. The ground rolled under his feet like a wave under a boat, and a large, warm hand planted itself in the center of his back and shoved him forward. He thought he ran with it for a step, maybe even two or three steps, and then he was lifted off his feet and hurled at the fence, where Cuthbert was no longer standing. Cuthbert was sprawled on his back, staring up at something behind Roland. The boy's eyes were wide and wondering, his mouth hung open. Roland could see all this very well, because Sitco was now as bright as in full daylight. They had lit their own reaping bonfire, it seemed, a night early and much brighter than the one in town could ever hope to be. He went skidding on his knees to where Cuthbert lay and grabbed him under one arm. From behind them came a vast, ripping roar, and now chunks of metal began to fall around them. They got up and ran toward where Alain stood in front of Susan and Sheemy, trying to protect them. Roland took a quick look back over his shoulder and saw that the remains of the derrick, about half of it still stood, were glowing blackish red like a heated horseshoe around a flaring yellow torch that ran perhaps 150 feet into the sky. It was a start. He didn't know how many other derricks they could fire before folk began arriving from town, but he was determined to do as many as possible, no matter what the risks might be. Blowing up the tankers at Hanging Rock was only half the job. Farson's source had to be wiped out. Further firecrackers dropped down further overflow pipes turned out not to be necessary. There was a network of interconnected pipes under the oil patch, most filled with natural gas that had leaked in through ancient decaying seals. Roland and Cuthbert had no more than reached the others when there was a fresh explosion, and a fresh tower of flame erupted from a derrick to the right of the one they had set afire. A moment later, a third derrick, this one 60 full yards away from the first two, exploded with a dragon's roar. The ironwork tore free of its anchoring concrete pillars like a tooth pulled from a decayed gum. It rose on a cushion of blazing blue and yellow, attained a height of perhaps 70 feet, then heeled over and came crashing back down, spewing sparks in every direction. Another. Another. And yet another. The five young people stood in their corner, stunned, holding their hands up to shield their eyes from the glare. Now the oil patch flared like a birthday cake, and the heat baking toward them was enormous. "Gods be kind," Alain whispered. If they lingered here much longer, Roland realized, they would be popped like corn. There were the horses to consider, too. They were well away from the main focus of the explosions, but there was no guarantee that the focus would stay where it was. Already he saw two derricks that hadn't even been working, engulfed in flames. The horses would be terrified. Hell, he was terrified. "Come on!" he shouted. They ran for the horses through shifting yellow-orange brilliance. 3. At first Jonas thought it was going on in his own head, that the explosions were part of their lovemaking. Lovemaking, yeah, lovemaking horse shit. He and Coral made love no more than donkeys did sums. But it was something. Oh, yes, indeed it was. He'd been with passionate women before, ones who took you into a kind of oven place and then held you there, staring with greedy intensity as they pumped their hips. But until Coral, he'd never been with a woman that sparked such a powerfully harmonic chord in himself. With sex, he had always been the kind of man who took it when it came and forgot it when it didn't. But with Coral, he only wanted to take it, take it, and take it some more. When they were together, they made love like cats or ferrets, twisting and hissing and clawing. They bit at each other and cursed at each other, and so far none of it was even close to enough. When he was with her, Jonas sometimes felt as if he were being fried in sweet oil. Tonight there had been a meeting with the Horsemen's Association, which had pretty much become the Farson Association in these latter days. Jonas had brought them up to date, had answered their idiotic questions, and had made sure they understood what they'd be doing the next day. With that done, he had checked on Rhea, who had been installed in Kimba Reimer's old suite. She hadn't even noticed Jonas peering in at her. She sat in Reimer's high-ceilinged, book-lined study, behind Reimer's ironwood desk, in Reimer's upholstered chair, looking as out of place as a whore's bloomers on a church altar. On Reimer's desk was the wizard's rainbow. She was passing her hands back and forth above it and muttering rapidly under her breath, but the ball remained dark. Jonas had locked her in and had gone to Coral. She had been waiting for him in the parlor where tomorrow's conversational would have been held. There were plenty of bedrooms in that wing, but it was to her dead brother's that she had led him, and not by accident either, Jonas was sure. There they made love in the canopied bed Hart Thorin would never share with his Jilly. It was fierce, as it had always been, and Jonas was approaching his orgasm when the first oil derrick blew. "Christ, she's something," he thought. "There's never in the whole damned world been a woman like then." Two more explosions in rapid succession, and Coral froze for a moment beneath him before beginning to thrust her hips again.
"Sitko," she said, in a hoarse, panting voice.
"Yar,"
he growled and began to thrust with her. He had lost all interest in making love, but they had reached the point where it was impossible to stop, even under threat of death or dismemberment. 2 minutes later, he was striding, naked, toward Thorin's little lick of a balcony, his half-erect penis wagging from side to side ahead of him like some half-wit's idea of a magic wand. Coral was a step behind him, as naked as he was.
"Why now?" she burst out as Jonas thrust open the balcony door. "I could have come 3 more times."
Jonas ignored her. The countryside looking northwest was a moon-gilded darkness, except where the oil patch was. There he saw a fierce yellow core of light. It was spreading and brightening even as he watched, one thudding explosion after another hammered across the intervening miles. He felt a curious darkening in his mind. That feeling had been there ever since the brat Dearborn, by some febrile leap of intuition, had recognized him for who and what he was. Making love to the energetic Coral melted that feeling a little, but now, looking at the burning tangle of fire which had 5 minutes ago been the good man's oil reserves, it came back with debilitating intensity, like a swamp fever that sometimes quits the flesh but hides in the bones and never really leaves. "You're in the West," Dearborn had said. "The soul of a man such as you can never leave the West." Of course it was true, and he hadn't needed any such titmonkey as Will Dearborn to tell him, but now that it had been said, there was a part of his mind that couldn't stop thinking about it. Fucking Will Dearborn. Where exactly was he now, him and his pair of good-mannered mates? In Avery's Calabozo? Jonas didn't think so. Not anymore. Fresh explosions ripped the